sifter.com.au.
G'day, I'm Chris Button and this is Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Unicorn Overlord is the latest hardcore strategy game from acclaimed Japanese developer Vanillaware, and Sifter's own Gianni DiGiovanni dived in, putting many hours in to find out if it's worth your time. First, let's check out the latest headlines from Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomew.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 28th of April.
Embracer is dead. The company will split up into three parts as CEO eats crow after the capitalist implosion reaches a conclusion.
Escape from Tarkov players are up in arms as developers introduce a $250 pay-to-win mode.
Fortnite will let you block those sweaty emotes with strangers that were just a little bit too mean if you want to.
And Fallout 76 hits a massive player milestone after the launch of the TV series.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
So, Gianni, Unicorn Overlord, bit of a funny name. What does that actually mean and what is this game?
Terrible name, like means nothing. It's like completely, well, there is a bit of context to it, but you know, if you're trying to describe it to people, and as I have been trying to do, recommend it to people, they go, what is that? What are you talking about? Anyway, so Unicorn Overlord, as you said, is by Vanillaware, who is a sort of strategy. They make a lot of sort of 2D style games, with and a lot of side-scrolling-y sort of stuff as well. So people probably might have played their most recent game, which is called 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim, which is sort of a sci-fi visual novel with a bit of a strategy element to it as well.
Brilliant game.
It's a really good game, underrated game, and I think a lot of people missed it when it came out, but definitely one of those really interesting titles. But it's a series. Unicorn Overlord is a grand fantasy role-playing game. It has a lot of the same bits and pieces that you might recognize from something like a Fire Emblem. It feels thematically a bit like a Fire Emblem, but it plays pretty differently, it's all about managing lots of different tactical squads, different classes within that, and also trying to balance out particular abilities against other classes. So really what you're trying to do is manage your resources within a battle and then also try to, bring your strongest troops to the battlefield. There's all sorts of stuff that you would love from one of those games. You know, there's equipment, there's places to discover, there's side quests, there's a romance subplot. It's got everything that the JRPG fantasy player loves to enjoy. And it's one of the most enjoyable pick-up-and-play games that I've played in a very in the last little bit. It's perfect for just playing a little bit, and maybe the sort of game you could fit in nicely in and amongst some of the bigger titles that require a lot more of you.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so interesting because I played a little bit of Unicorn Overlord myself, having played the entirety of 13 Sentinels, which is one of my favorite games in recent years. And one of the big differences from my sort of immediate impressions of Unicorn Overlord is that it's perhaps not quite as narratively dense as 13 Sentinels, or at least it doesn't front load that into the early part of the experience. Does that track with your time with Unicorn Overlord in terms of this game is perhaps for people who want a mechanically meaty game as opposed to the mind-bending sort of time-altering narrative that 13 Sentinels wowed plenty of us with?
Yeah, look, definitely. I think if you look at a game like 13 Sentinels, which was much more about puzzling out a sort of complex and twisty story, this is much more straightforward. It's you know, a standard, you know, Prince Alain, who was the son of the queen, he's the heir to the throne of Cornia, has been forced out after a general of the former empire betrayed the kingdom, basically, and took over and crowned himself as emperor. And so basically the whole idea is that what you're trying to do is trying to reclaim the throne, but also free the different kingdoms that were originally separate sort of kingdoms all around the Kingdom of Cornia, like Elheim, where all the elves live, and Bastorius, where they where all the sort of beast people, the furry people live, and all of these other ones. So you're basically trying to save all those different kingdoms from this evil empire, and it's just, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Sort of, you know, you're up against a, you know, a Sauron sort of character, effectively, and kind of working your way through that sort of plot. But what's quite cool about it is that there's lots of those little threads for you to pull on, and as you kind of move your way through different areas, you kind of get a different picture about how each of these particular cultures were impacted by this invading army. So for example, like, you know, that the elves were kind of off in their own little secluded forest for a while, and then they you know, the first big interaction they had with humans, the human empire, was that they came in and brought their invading army and sort of subjugated and sold the elves off and enslaved them and things like that. So, you know, there's a bit of skepticism when you are another invading army, this time on the side of liberation, but you know, there is a bit of skepticism there, and you kind of have to build up the trust as you're going through. And look, it's not, you know, Game of Thrones level complexity or anything like that, but it is it has a nice sort of pretty approachable and pretty nicely paced storyline that you can kind of pick at in whatever direction you'd like, because the world itself, you know, you've got the kind of the Fevereth, which is the sort of continent, island continent, that's all the communities are kind of based around, is you know, is split up into these little different sections, and yeah, they're kind of gated by level. So you are expected to kind of go in a particular direction, but once you've kind of made it through the first part of the, you know, the main kingdom of Cornia, the central kingdom, you can decide whether or not you want to head off into the desert land and, you know, where all the dragons used to live, but there's none left anymore, so it's just skeletons everywhere, or do you want to head off into the direction of the elves? So, you know, I think you can kind of follow where you want, and it's really easy to move between bits and pieces as well. So you're not stuck in a path, for example, if you decide you want to do a bit of the desert and it's getting you down, or you want to improve your, you know, the availability of classes that you have access to. You can just decide to jump on over to where the elves campaign is straight away and jump in there as well. So, you know, it's as you sort of started by asking, it's not got that mind twisty aspect. The challenge and the enjoyable part of this is more of the tactical and systems-based gameplay rather than a game that you will be thinking about the story for years to come. Look, it's fine. The story is fine. It's slightly better than fine. I'd say it's good, but it's nothing you're going to be remembering for years and years to come, I don't think, at this stage. But, you know, I'm about 40 hours in or so, so it hasn't wowed me in the same way. I was just kind of like on the edge of my seat, like in 13 Sentinels.
As long as it's not the drastic drop that I experienced between Fire Emblem Three Houses and then Fire Emblem Engage, I think I'll be just fine. But that mechanical complexity, again, as to reiterate, is very much the star of the show here with Unicorn Overlord. And from what I've played, as you say, it's very interesting sort of navigating this this overworld, interacting with the various sort of citizens of the regions, and you do have a lot of flexibility and freedom to tackle things in various order within reason, because there are things that are sort of level gated as well. There are things that you certainly wouldn't be able to attempt straight up, otherwise you have no chance in hell of succeeding. But I think to go back to the core elements of this game, it's a really interesting take on what I feel the auto battler genre, which I think has sort of increased in popularity, or has sort of become popularized in recent years with some a few games on Steam and some browser based games as well. But this certainly cranks up the sort of auto battler strategy up to 11 with a lot of the unit sort of customizations and the way that you can sort of position your units within a battle, because you've got these two rows where you can have your frontline units who are good at dealing damage, taking hits, backed up by people on the back row who are support or healers or archers, those who still have a lot of utility, but aren't necessarily going to be ones who will be able to bear the brunt of, you know, a lot of damage from opposition sort of units and battalions. So tell me about how this combat system works and how you navigate your way through battles and sort of what's so satisfying about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Auto Battlers kind of came to mind as well when I was thinking of this game. And it's sort of because when you kind of build these little squads, I think your initial thought when you see the game being played is that you'd actually be selecting commands, because it kind of feels a bit like almost like an old school Final Fantasy, like a side scrolling sort of game. So that's what it looks like when you play it. But what happens is you assemble your squads and pick the equipment that they're going to be using. And then you basically move them around the map and come up against enemies. And much like in Fire Emblem, you're kind of given an indication how you're going to go before you actually get into the battle. So basically you can kind of choose, at that stage you might be in a real tactical disadvantage. So you've got the opportunity that if enemies are nearby, another unit that you have, you can kind of swap them directly. It doesn't matter if they're right in the line of fire, basically. You can just do a straight swap. So, you know, quite often I had a squad of healers who were nearby my main attacking army, and they sometimes would get caught offside by a fast-moving flying enemy, for example, that kind of scout around me. But because they were close enough to my main sort of hero squad, I was able to very quickly swap them between the two. And the good thing about that is you're kind of just building up lots of different little additions to each battle that you do. So, for example, if my healer squad is getting attacked directly, yeah, they can heal within that battle, and that's part of the actual gameplay part of it. So, you know, everything kind of runs in a script order. There are many of these sort of RPGs which kind of run in this sort of like turn-based order, and you can move your things up and down the initiative. But for example, if I move them out of the actual combat and put my heavy hitting heroes in instead, that squad that's now not in the direct fire can actually provide a healing assist if I've made that particular person the leader, like the healer, one of the healers of the leaders of the squad. So, you know, you can actually think about your composition of how you, who you make the leader of each particular squad that you have to give you sort of situational bonuses within each of the battles in the game. But you can also, you know, for example, have three healers in the back row, which makes for a really good one. Or you might just want to have one healer there and actually give that squad a number of quite heavy hitters as well. So you can make the healer the hero so that they give you the leader, the advantage in the tactical mode. But in the battles, you can fill it with knights and still have like pack quite a punch as well. So that composition between what units you put into each squad in the two rows that you have. You got two rows of three, so there's six potential positions, and you can upgrade to five units max, which by the time you've gotten to that point, you're pretty powerful. So, you know, you can really make complex sort of squads. It's all about thinking about those particular synergies between each of the classes that you've got in the squad. So, like, for an example, I'm going to take you through my main squad where Elaine, the protagonist of the game, is in. So Elaine has a pretty strong, he's an armored knight. He's got a pretty strong ability that means that he can, anytime he attacks anyone, he gets a proportion of his health back. He's got like a health steal sort of ability, but he's also got quite a strong shield ability as well, which means that he can basically protect some of the other weaker units. In that squad, I've also got Hodrick, who's like a large sort of legionnaire character. He was like a hoplite, with a spear and a very large shield, and it's just a tank and basically just takes damage and buffs the other members of the squad to reduce the amount of damage they take. I've got an elven fencer who also sits on the front line, has a reasonable amount of health, probably middle health, but has the sort of combination magical and physical attacks, so is sort of doing sword strikes and then blasting them with lightning. And then in my back row, I've got a spear-wielding soldier, which can attack in their own right as well, who's pretty strong at that, but most of the time is spending their points within the battle buffing different abilities. So they will give a guaranteed hits, for example, to particular spells. So any other modifiers get wiped out, or they'll make sure that every hit you get is a critical hit. So that's really improving your ability. And finally, in the last member of my squad is a witch, and she's got powerful magical abilities, but also has that same sort of thing where she can buff different characters when they're about to do their moves as well. So you know, there's a lot of these little bits and pieces you can put to kind of combine your squads, and you can kind of pick the things that you like between all of those different elements. And so I picked up that, you know, that main squad that I've got is, you know, is pretty unstoppable now because and pretty much everyone is kind of a vehicle to sort of support those squads. But you know, you think about the composition of other squads to fulfill other tactical aspects of it. So there's a number of flying units, for example, you can have, and they're not impacted by any environmental traps like, you know, spike traps or bombs or anything like that. And they just fly over the top of water and all of these sorts of things. So often I'm using them to go and claim faraway little control points, which give me this resource, which allows me to deploy more squads or use special abilities in the maps as well. So, you know, you're kind of balancing all those little aspects, and it's like a semi-real-time game in that, like, you know, a lot of the stuff is sort of turn-based, but, you know, the movement around the map, you kind of set off all these orders and people kind of move around. And I think probably a game like Phantom Brigade, it was like a mech game that came out a little while ago, is sort of a similar idea. You're basically setting up all your orders and then hoping that the particular squads all come into the right place. So there's a lot there to enjoy. And one of the things that's really cool about it is because with that squad composition, you can actually set tactics and priorities. And this is where it's a bit like Final Fantasy XII as well. If you're listening to this thinking, wow, there's a lot going on in this game. Well, there is, but it's not so complex that you get overwhelmed. But it uses a tactics mode, and which is similar to the Gambit system that was in Final Fantasy XII for your squad mates. And, you know, because of that, you are actually, you don't control any of them directly. So it's a bit more like you're controlling a whole group of your companions in Final Fantasy XII. And yeah, so you can say, okay, well, you know, Hodrick, who's my legionnaire with the big shield, I want him to prioritize protecting the back row because the back row are the squishiest. They're going to take the most damage. If they take a physical hit, they're going to go down, but I need them to be protected. So we put Hodrick in the line of fire effectively to do that. And, you know, Elaine, who's got his, you know, health stealing attack, I get him to prioritize enemies that are the weakest in the enemy squad, because if he kills an enemy with that particular attack, it doubles the amount of health he gets. He'll get like a small amount, but if he kills them, he gets double as much. So I can set to prioritize the weakest unit. So there's a lot of that really cool stuff that you can do to kind of customize the way that the game actually plays. You can, you know, there's moves because of those two rows of units that you've got. You can say, okay, well, I know I've got a very wide attack that's going to attack the first row entirely. So I'm going to prioritize attacking entire rows so I can do the most damage possible. Or you can say there's a, you know, a row of a column of two, for example, and you might say, okay, I'm just going to go attack those two specifically rather than, like, you know, all of that sort of stuff. It's, you can set priorities for all of these sort of things. So you can get quite granular with this. And I reckon you could build some pretty wild builds that are, you know, totally game breaking, but it's kind of the fun of the tactical squad based gameplay in Unicorn Overlord.
Yeah, well, you well and truly preempted the next point I was going to bring up in terms of it's not just unit composition, it's also the order customization of, you know, what these units will actually do in battle. Because I think people who like conditional programming, conditional formatting, or going really deep into, okay, if X, then Y, there's a lot of this super deep customization, which you don't have to engage with if you don't want to, but for those who really want to min-max and get the absolute most out of their units, their squads, and each combat encounter, then yeah, you can do that because, you know, you can set, if someone has both an attack or a support ability, you can set it for that. If, okay, if their health is below 50% or an ally's health is below 50%, prioritize doing the support action before attacking, or vice versa. And that's just scraping the very absolute surface of the sort of conditional commands that you can program into these units ahead of each encounter. And I think that that's also a big part of Unicorn Overlord, is that there are continual upgrades, there are continual new sort of mechanics or unit types to play around with, because as you mentioned, you can have up to 5 units at any given point, but you only start out with each little battalion being able to house 3 units each. And with each quest that you do, with, you know, various upgrade points that you earn through your in-game actions, you can then spend those to upgrade units, level them up, you know, so they get stronger statistically, their base stats improve, but then also increase the amounts of units that you can have within each squad, you know, up to 5, as you said. And going from 3 to 4 units is quite a substantial change, because that then opens up so many other tactical possibilities that you can contend with and play around with. But then also the unit types that you encounter as well, because a lot of the first units are very melee based. They're, you know, traditional knights and archers and that sort of thing. Whereas it doesn't take long until you get, you know, dedicated support healers, dedicated witches who can do debuffs or penetrate armor more so than physical weapons. So it's a game that keeps evolving and revealing new wrinkles to its systems, which I think lends itself to that philosophy that you said right from the outset, that this is a game ideal for playing in small chunks, having a little bit of an experience here and there, and next time you come back, there'll be something a bit fresh for you to enjoy. But it's also something that you could realistically play for hours on end, and, you know, encounter new things as you keep playing. So it's something that Unicorn Overlord did quite well from the little bit that I play as well. But speaking of witches in particular, there's something about Vanillaware that is very much a recurring motif throughout all of its games, and that is of its character designs. And this is quite a good looking game, and they do very interesting things with the art style, which, you know, was sort of iterated on 13 Sentinels as well, which was a very visually striking and a game that had a very unique art style. But one thing that has been a constant among Vanillaware games is very much is a depiction of women, and it's impossibly proportioned ones at that, whose back pain I certainly feel for. Was that something that you picked up during your playtime as well, Gianni?
Look, in some characters, they're really cool. Like, you know, yeah, you've got a number of them, particularly the women in the game, you know, they look like they're armored soldiers, right? And they look like they're in a fantasy one. I know there's a character called Miriam, for example, who's like this holy knight. And she's got like a bit of a, you know, high ponytail as part of it, just to show that she's a hero character kind of to do this. But, you know, she looks like she could walk into battle. And then, as you said, there's the witches, for example, which are just in basically bikinis with a bit of like mesh top over the top sort of thing and a little mesh skirt thing. And they're kind of hip shaking their way around the battles. And it, like, those moments are so stark, and it's really strange. And it's just, it's like very fan servicey in a way that makes me feel like quite uncomfortable. So, you know, and like it's sort of peppered throughout the game. All of a sudden you just come across a character like the elves, for example, that elven fencer that I mentioned, for example, like they're like basically in the world's smallest leotard, completely exposed to the elements. And like, well, I'm fighting through a snowy biome at the moment, and, you know, it's just completely, completely impractical. And the animations of it as well, it's just got a very, very particular look at the way they depict women in it. And I think most people would think it's pretty gross, actually, if you're looking at it from, you know, from a 2024 perspective. So, you know, I don't know. It's one of these things where it's like this is probably the major downfall if you're going to put points against this game, is that, you know, all of these things, it really falls into that very sort of juvenile trope of having the buxom lady soldier who's completely in the boob armor, basically, sort of thing. And it doesn't really make any sense. But then on the other side, there are other characters who do it really well. So I don't know. It's not great. It's definitely not great. There's definitely something that is a very strange about the way that they've actually done it. But it's kind of been part of the Vanillaware thing for a really long time. Even 13 Sentinels, which felt pretty toned down in comparison to this. This is much more much more over the top than 13 Sentinels was. But that one, I remember playing that game and going, whoa, this is just quite full on. So, yeah, I don't know. It's up to you. Depends if this is something that's a deal breaker for you. If you can kind of chalk it up to, like, this is unfortunately the type of game that they've designed. Because on the whole, the art is really gorgeous. So, you know, it's not an accident that they've done it this way, because it's such an incredibly beautifully designed and drawn game. So, yeah, I think you just have to sort of sit with yourself and decide whether or not this is a deal breaker for you in the way that it depicts a lot of the women in this game who, in every other aspect, despite the way that they're being dressed, are kind of written pretty well. There is an element of as well because, you know, this is this sort of JRPG and there's sort of a romance facility in that as well. There's kind of like a culminating quest that kind of leads towards that. And there's relationships pretty similar to Fire Emblem. That feels sort of Fire Emblem-y, but, you know, from a much more basic perspective.
Thank you, Melisandre.
That's not all I want, though. Once you claim the throne, I'll be expecting a place at your side for real.
Sorry?
Oh, don't worry. I'm not asking to be queen. Just one of the few dozen consorts every king calls upon.
Fascinating, yes. Let's discuss it another time, shall we?
In many ways, it does feel like quite a few of the women who are soldiers in your army are kind of all fawning around you in a way as the main character. Like, it's a bit of a harem anime, yeah, in a way too. So there's that aspect of it as well, which I think feels like it's just a very big genre trope for this particular type of JRPG. But yeah, I don't know. In terms of, like, some of the characters are just incredible. There's like a knight who's an angel called Oclis, and she just wears this really cool outfit and she looks like she's ready to go to battle. But, you know, I quite like her and she's not depicted in that way at all. But yeah, then you've got, you know, elves like Raelanor who literally look like they're about to do a gymnastics routine, and they've got a few leg greaves on them and that's about it. So yeah, it's quite over the top in the way that they've designed some of these characters. So, you know, mileage may vary on that one.
Yeah, I think that the main thing that makes it egregious in you know, some of the ridiculous character design is the tonal mismatch, is in that, you know, characters, a well-written character, you know, who owns their sexuality, you know, is still a great character, but it's the fact that these characters sort of look the way they do, but there doesn't seem to be any characterization or narrative justification behind it. It's more just ogle these characters for the sake of it.
There is a little bit for the main witch character, Yana, actually in some of the companion quests that you do. You have a couple of the soldiers in your army when you kind of build up the relationship between, you know, your side characters can also have like conversations with them too. And Yana, for example, Hodrick, who's that big sort of tanky soldier dude that I was talking about before, he, you know, kind of goes, why, you know, I feel a bit off put and overcome by this, but, you know, her storyline is that, you know, she's a witch and she's managed to hide herself away by changing her appearance. And she's like hundreds and hundreds of years old. And she's like, look, I haven't felt like this and looked like this for a really long time. So, you know, I'm kind of taking advantage of the fact that I'm a young person again. So that's the reason why I'm wearing it. As for all the other witches, well, that's just the way the character is designed, you know. So, but they do sort of talk about that a little bit, which I was surprised to see, because obviously they had someone in the office or anyone said, yeah, look, you probably should mention this in some capacity. But yeah, anyway, it's one aspect of a game that is quite complex, and you go, oh, okay, classic vanilla wear. And you sort of roll your eyes, you know, be embarrassed as people walk into the house looking at you playing this game, because it's very pervy. So,
yeah, I know I got a few eye rolls from my partner at times. So sort of, but we've had enough anime on the house that it's sort of like, all right, you know, typical anime. But with all that considered, obviously, what really stands out here is the combat and the strategy and how much planning and thinking there is involved in Unicorn Overlord. So do you drop or rate this game, Gianni?
Yeah, look, I definitely rate it. And I think that I played this on the Switch. It runs beautifully on the Switch. It's available also on the Xbox and PlayStation as well. And yeah, I really like it because I think it's quite big. I haven't really even talked about like the fact that there's like world quests as well. So you can kind of go around and liberate different towns, and you're taking resources across and building up those towns. And, you know, there's a whole cooking and relationship thing as well, where you can go and have like these incredibly rendered, beautiful meals with your colleagues and sort of build up these little side quests and conversations with them as well. But yeah, it's a sort of game that's like, it feels, what it reminds me of is a bit like an MMO in that, you know, you can kind of jump into the world and you can kind of go off and complete any number of tasks in any direction. So you can kind of decide what you want to do. So, you know, if you decide you want to mine, go to the mines, there's like a mining mini game, and you can go and collect a bunch of resources so you can build up a number of towns. You can go do that for a bit. Or if you want to go and, you know, reclaim a few villages or do some side quests through that, you can go do that. Or if you want to build up those relationships and have those character conversations, you can go do that. So the tactical gameplay is really fun. It never got boring at all. I've done hundreds and hundreds of battles now. And, you know, if you know that you're going to completely stomp an enemy, that sort of little combat moment can be quite long. So you can go and skip that as well. But, you know, you can just jump into a battle and play and have a really fun time. It's actually really enjoyable to do that. So in terms of whether I'd drop it or rate it, I would definitely rate it. It's going to be a game that I think will be another cult hit, because I think Vanillaware games are ones that don't always garner the same, you know, mass reach as other games do. But I think one of these series that I reckon people will continue to play, and I really look forward to seeing the crazy tactical builds that people put together, specifically because there's actually like a multiplayer mode. You can actually fight against other people's squads as well. So once people get completely ridiculous using the systems in this game, I think it'll be really fun to see how this game goes down the track.
Excellent. And from what little I've played so far, I certainly rate it, and I'm looking forward to putting many, many hours into Unicorn Overlord over the next little while.
Hey there, Gianni here on the latest episode of Lightmap, Sifter's interview podcast. Trent Custers from Melbourne's League of Geeks joins me to share the pretty candid story of how their studio almost came to its end.
The thing that I said to Blake, who's the game director on Jumplight Odyssey, and, you know, we've got to remind ourselves, is that it literally was just a logic puzzle. Like, we did not have enough money to take one team all the way through till, say, late 2024, which is the amount of time that Jumplight Odyssey needed to be completed. We've got to put this one game that's already out there that has a bunch of potential, and then invested in this other game that, you know, very clearly, because we can see the wish list doesn't have this, and it's always been the case, like Solium Inferno is the weirdo strategy game, right? It was never the commercial front runner out of the two. You know, you don't get to pick and choose. It actually, the decision is made for you.
You can get every episode of Lightmap for free on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube, or head to our website, sifter.com.au.
Sit down for a chat with your pals in video games.
You're listening to Sifter.
This has been Drop Rate by Sifter, our video game review podcast. Thank you to Atlas and Sega for providing a review copy of Unicorn Overlord on Nintendo Switch. It's out now on Switch, Xbox, and PlayStation. But in the meantime, Gianni, recently award-winning games journalist, where can people find more of your work?
Yes, you can find all of my stuff on sifter.com.au. I pretty much have a hand in just about everything that we make, so that's probably the best place to go. So I'd recommend, if you want to hear my interviews, I do mostly the interviews on the show Lightmap. That's the main show that I do. We've got a really interesting one coming up with Trent Custers, which may be in the feed by the time you listen to this, from Armello creating League of Geeks. They've also just released Solium Infernum, which is another deep strategy game. So if that's this sort of game is one that's caught your fancy, and that might be one to check out. And Trent talks pretty candidly about the fact that the studio, which was held up as one of Australia's best and most aspirational studios, came so close to the brink, they were literally having to borrow money against future earnings on things. So it's a really fascinating and candid conversation. So I recommend you jump into your podcast player, search for Lightmap by Sifter, Just search for Lightmap and you should be able to find it there. Definitely one to have a look at.
It's a big episode and one that I hope plenty of people tune into because it's a very interesting time in the games industry right now. Thanks to Brian Fairbanks from Salty Dog Sounds for composing the theme music. And Sifter is produced by Chris Button, Courtney Barrett, Kyle Poletto, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Daniel Ang, and Adam Christo. Mitch Lowe is senior producer, and Gianni Di Giovanni is our executive producer. And if you like games coverage in written form, you can head to sifter.com.au for articles, interviews, and more. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next time.